Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. Have you ever felt that tension? You know, that real friction between knowing something's absolutely crucial for long-term success, something you actually desire to achieve, but then the relentless daily grind just makes it feel like, oh, well, like an annoying, time-consuming obligation. Maybe it's that big strategic planning session that always gets bumped for, you know, more urgent operational fires, or
Yeah.
maybe that vital review meeting that just feels like a bureaucratic checkbox you have to tick.
Right. Not a real chance to improve.
Exactly, rather than a genuine opportunity. Today, we're taking a deep dive into exactly that, why quality in organizations so often feels like this heavy bureaucratic burden, particularly when it comes to, well, vital activities like management reviews. And maybe more importantly, why leaders might actually see it as, frankly, an annoying waste of time. It's really about that frustrating, deep-seated conflict, isn't it? Between wanting excellence and feeling like it's impossible to actually embed to all the daily pressures.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here is that our source, Qualita, Un viaggio tra desiderio e possibilità per il biologico Massimo Plavsic, it tackles this head-on, this very human, very organizational conflict. It really zeroes in on a sentiment that's widespread, particularly observed in the Italian context, often summed up by that phrase, vorrei ma non posso.
I would like to, but I can't.
Precisely. I would like to, but I can't. It's this idea that there's a genuine desire for quality. People acknowledge it's important. But there's an equally pervasive feeling of being constrained, blocked. And that often leads management to view the practical side, especially those essential but seemingly time-sucking tasks, like management reviews, as, well, nothing short of a nuisance. It's this core reluctance to invest the necessary time that we really need to get into. So our mission in this deep dive is to pull out the most impactful insights from Plavsic's work. We'll look at the historical roots of this perception, try to pinpoint the actual obstacles that feed this view of quality as just an annoyance, and then, really importantly, explore concrete, actionable strategies, things you can actually do to bridge this desire possibility gap. The aim is to transform that I would like to, but I can't, into a proactive I want to and I can, shifting quality, from that bureaucratic burden into a genuine strategic value driver.
Okay, so when we talk about quality in modern organizations, it's certainly moved way beyond just ticking boxes or hitting minimum standards. We all know that, right? But it's maybe precisely this expanded definition that creates the tension, isn't it? It's meant to be this multidimensional concept, kind of permeating everything from product design right through to customer experience. And our source really focuses on the shift. It's just not enough anymore for a product to meet the technical specs. The entire experience has to align with, or ideally, exceed customer expectations. It has to generate tangible value in this complex, fast-changing world we're in. It's about satisfying both the explicit and the implicit needs of all stakeholders, which, okay, requires a systematic approach embedded into every single aspect of the organization. But for a manager who's already feeling overwhelmed, this very breadth, this scope, can feel like just another weight to carry, another layer of bureaucracy,
Exactly.
which, ironically, makes them less likely to engage, especially in things like time-consuming reviews.
That's precisely the contradiction, Plavsic highlights. It's central. While organizations say quality is important, they frequently treat it as just a formal compliance exercise, completely missing its substantial value. Our source actually distinguishes three interpretations of quality, which kind of illustrates this often stalled evolution. First, there's the foundational view. Quality is conformity. This is just adherence to minimum requirements, often driven by the need for certifications, It's about meeting basic criteria, nothing more fancy.
The tick box exercise.
Exactly. Then you have a more evolved view. Quality is strategy. Here, quality is integrated directly into strategic planning, becomes part of the organization's identity, maybe a distinct competitive advantage. It's about actually using quality to gain market share or differentiate yourself. But the most mature approach, the one that's hardest to reach, is quality as culture. Where it's a shared value guiding every behavior, every decision, every action, automatically. The real challenge and the heart of their paradox here is bridging that gap, getting from that initial, often bureaucratic conformity mindset to a truly strategic and cultural integration. And the book's title itself, Qualità, Viaggio tra Desiderio e Possibilità, Quality, A Journey Between Desire and Possibility. It just perfectly captures this vorrei ma non posso paradox. It's this widespread recognition of quality's importance colliding head-on with an equally widespread resistance to really implementing it fully. And this tension, it plays out on multiple levels that managers feel very acutely. First, there's the dichotomy of value versus cost. In principle, okay, quality is seen as a value, something good, beneficial. But in practice, it's almost always perceived primarily as a cost. Plavsic argues this is a profound cognitive bias. The immediate expenses, like, say, investing time in a management review or buying new software or training people, they're tangible. They hit the budget now.
You can see them on the spreadsheet.
Exactly. You can see them.
Yeah.
But the benefits, fewer errors down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Happier customers, long-term brand loyalty. They seem uncertain, deferred, and they're notoriously harder to quantify, especially in the short term. So the short-term kind of myopic view makes quality an easy target for cost-cutting, which just fuels the perception that it's a burden, not an investment. Why invest precious time in a management review if its value isn't immediately obvious on the balance sheet, right? Second big one, the conflict between time and quality. We live in a world of constant urgency, feels like it anyway, daily operational demands, immediate deadlines, putting out fires. It just consumes managers' time.
All the time.
Yeah. And this constantly clashes with the need to dedicate consistent time and resources to strategic quality initiatives, including those vital management reviews. These systems require consistent planning, training, ongoing monitoring, activities that are rarely seen as urgent in the day-to-day chaos.
They're important but not urgent, that classic trap.
That's the trap. And so they constantly sidelined. As the source aptly puts it, the tyranny of urgency is one of the most insidious enemies of quality. When everything is urgent, nothing is truly important.
Mm-hmm.
And this hits right at the heart of why management reviews, despite their potential long-term benefits, get neglected or rushed through.
Mm-hmm.
And third, there's this tension between formalism and substance. Many organizations kind of oscillate, you know, between a bureaucratic adherence to quality, focusing heavily on documents, procedures, formal compliance, often just to get certified.
So just to pass the audit.
Just to pass the audit. And then the real difficulty of translating quality principles into substantial integrated daily practices. This often reduces things like an audit or even a management review from what should be a genuine learning opportunity into merely a test to pass, which leads to defensive, reactive behaviors, not proactive, constructive ones. If the primary goal is just satisfying an external auditor, well, it's no wonder managers see these activities as an annoying waste of time. You know, William A. Foster famously said, "Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of intelligent intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. It represents the wise choice among many alternatives." And that quote, it really captures the intentional, strategic nature of true quality. So this raises the big question, doesn't it? If it's so fundamental, so strategic, why does it so frequently get sidelined or seen as just a chore? Particularly by management, who might feel it's an annoying waste of time, especially those crucial, potentially time-consuming management reviews.
So, what does this all mean for you listening? It means many organizations are caught in this very common trap. Quality is acknowledged as important, sure, but the practical effort needed to actually embed it feels like this never-ending uphill battle. It's this inherent tension, isn't it, between wanting to do the right thing and feeling utterly overwhelmed by the perceived obstacles to actually doing it. That's what we need to dissect. Okay, so our source dives deep into several key obstacles, things that contribute to this "I would like to, but I can't" state of affairs, with a really sharp focus on why management perceives quality activities as such a nuisance. And these aren't just, you know, minor inconveniences. They're deeply ingrained issues that directly feed that perception of quality as an annoying waste of time.
Yeah, and one of the most concrete, most pervasive obstacles is undoubtedly time pressure.
Mm.
Plavsic's research points to this relentless tyranny of urgency. It creates a constant battle between the immediate operational demands and the strategic need for quality improvement. And this isn't just about having busy schedules. It's a profound cognitive trap, really. Managers are kind of wired to respond to immediate crises, right? The fire alarm from a production line stoppage just screams louder than the quiet hum of a strategic quality review that promises long-term benefits.
It's human nature, almost.
And the source offers some pretty compelling statistics on this. Get this. 78% of managers report frequent interruptions due to operational urgencies as the primary obstacle to quality improvement activities.
Wow, nearly 8 out of 10.
Yeah. 8 out of 10 managers constantly derail by immediate demands. Furthermore, 65% of their work time is spent managing urgent situations instead of planned quality improvements.
So most of their day is reactive.
Exactly. Reactive, not proactive. And maybe the most disheartening one,
yeah.
42% of quality initiatives are postponed or abandoned entirely because of what are considered more urgent operational priorities in the immediate term. This is why things like management review meetings, which should be these critical moments for strategic reflection,
yeah,
often become mere formal fulfillments, quick boxes to tick rather than deep dives into performance because there's simply no time to engage meaningfully.
And it's not just time, is it? It's often seen as a direct hit to the budget, too. That immediate, tangible cost of quality implementation, even if it promises long-term gains, that can be a major deterrent for management, right? Making it feel like an annoyance rather than an investment.
Absolutely. The perception of quality as a cost is another massive hurdle, especially the source notes. In small and medium-sized Italian enterprises, which often operate with pretty limited resources, this view is a core component of that vorrei ma non posso paradox. The problem has deep roots. Cognitively, there's this strong bias. Organizations tend to evaluate the costs of quality as immediate and highly tangible. You can see the invoice for new software, right? Or a consultant's fee, or the hours people spend in training.
It's right there in black and white.
It's right there. Meanwhile, the benefits reduced errors, increased customer loyalty, a stronger brand they're perceived as uncertain, deferred, and notoriously difficult to quantify in the short term. So this asymmetry, it naturally favors investments with more immediate and measurable returns, which makes building a compelling case for quality investment incredibly difficult for management to justify sometimes. Operationally, many organizations genuinely struggle to quantify what Plavsic calls the costs of non-quality. These are the hidden drains, errors, defects, reworks, inefficiencies, customer complaints, and crucially, lost customers. Because these costs are often hidden or not systematically tracked, organizations fail to adequately value the potential benefits of quality systems.
So they don't see what they're saving by investing.
Exactly. Which just perpetuates this vicious cycle where quality remains stuck as a pure cost in the eyes of management. They see the direct costs, certification expenses, the time required for implementation, personnel training, external consulting fees, investments in dedicated technologies. What they often miss are the substantial, yet maybe indirect, benefits, like a significant reduction in inefficiencies, increased value for the customer, improved customer satisfaction leading to loyalty, all of which are much harder to put a precise number on in the short term, which just reinforces that waste of time perception.
Okay, so beyond time and money, there's also the very human element of resistance. That can be a huge hurdle too, right? Even if the numbers eventually added up, people naturally resist change, don't they?
Oh, that's a critical point. Resistance to change is probably one of the most pervasive and subtle obstacles to implementing effective quality systems. It's deeply rooted in human nature, and it gets amplified by organizational dynamics. It often creates this invisible but extremely powerful barrier that feeds the vorrei ma non posso paradox. On an individual level, resistance often shows up through defensive behaviors or maybe open skepticism. People naturally prefer what's familiar. Change feels like a threat to their security, their competence, maybe even their status. New quality systems often require abandoning old practices, learning new skills, sometimes redefining roles, all of which generates anxiety. And this resistance, it can manifest in all sorts of ways. It can be passive, like, okay, formal adherence but low commitment or subtle delaying tactics, or it can be active. Open criticism, declared opposition, maybe even subtle sabotage. It can be rational, based on seemingly logical arguments about costs, risks, feasibility. Or it can be purely emotional, driven by fear of the unknown or anxiety about looking incompetent. In the specific context of quality systems, this resistance gets fueled by common but often distorted perceptions. Quality is often seen as control from above, limiting individual autonomy. Systems are viewed as bureaucratic overhead, requiring endless documentation. Standardization is perceived as a threat to individual know-how, especially in artisan contexts.
Yeah, I can see that.
And this unfortunate combination transforms things like the quality audit and even regular management reviews from what should be a learning opportunity into merely a test to pass, leading to defensive, reactive behaviors, not proactive, constructive ones. People are just trying to get through it with minimum perceived effort or exposure.
So even if they wanted to change, maybe they just don't know how. Which leads to another major obstacle, a fundamental skills gap. This feels like a self-reinforcing problem, doesn't it?
Precisely. The competence gaps obstacle is one of the most concrete barriers to effective quality implementation, particularly noted in Italian organizations. It directly contributes to the vorrei ma non posso paradox. This training gap shows up at various levels, right from top management down to operational staff. It creates both a technical and a cultural barrier. The problem's complex because quality management requires this integration of technical, methodological, organizational, and relational knowledge. It's not just about knowing the rules, it's about translating abstract principles into concrete practices and adapting them to the organization's specific context. Plavsic highlights a significant managerial gap. Many managers, while maybe acknowledging quality's importance, lack a deep understanding of its principles and methodologies. This often leads to just full delegation of quality management to specialist figures without real strategic involvement from the top.
So it becomes the quality person's job.
Exactly. Not my problem. And this absence of informed leadership significantly limits the effectiveness of quality systems, often reducing them to just a formal compliance exercise rather than a true driver for improvement. If the top isn't truly engaged, well, it's easy for them to view a management review as just a formal report out, not a strategic lever. And even among quality professionals, there can be significant gaps. Some develop an overly bureaucratic, normative approach, focusing just on formal compliance over substantial improvement, box ticking. Others might lack essential soft skills like effective communication, change management, or complex data analysis. This limits their effectiveness as agents of change and often relegates them to a marginal tick box role. And finally, there's just insufficient widespread training at the operational level. Many employees perceive quality procedures as impositions without truly understanding their meaning or benefits. Training, when it exists, often focuses only on technicalities and procedures, neglecting the crucial cultural dimension quality as an approach to work oriented towards continuous excellence. This competence gap has direct consequences. You get superficial implementation, where systems are formally adopted but not truly integrated. You get a reductive interpretation, where quality is just equated to mere regulatory compliance, losing its strategic and innovative potential. Cultural resistance gets fueled by a lack of understanding. And there's an inability to adapt to changing contexts, leaving organizations anchored to rigid, ineffective models. And underpinning all of these obstacles, absolutely crucial, is the role, or often the painful absence, of committed leadership. Plazek makes it abundantly clear, the ultimate quality an organization can achieve is severely limited by the quality of its leadership. If leaders view quality as a nuisance, an imposition, or just a cost, that perception will inevitably spread like wildfire throughout the entire structure, turning potential into pervasive problems.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. If leaders themselves see quality as a burden, as something imposed rather than embraced, then these very real obstacles we've talked about, the time pressure, the perceived cost, the human resistance, the skills gap, they all become amplified, right?
Absolutely. Magnified.
It creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, doesn't it? A narrative that just confirms, see, quality is an annoying waste of time, especially for crucial activities like management reviews. It's this vicious cycle that really needs to be broken by addressing the root causes of that managerial perception, not just treating the symptoms. So to truly understand where we are and why quality is perceived as such a burden sometimes, we need a quick focus trip through history. How did quality management evolve, especially in Italy, a country renowned for its Made in Italy excellence, but also, as our source points out, grappling intensely with this rema non posso paradox? What historical moments maybe cemented this view?
Yeah, indeed. The evolution of quality systems in Italy is a fascinating journey. It's uniquely shaped by its socioeconomic context, its industrial structure, and its cultural specifics. Our source breaks it down into these distinct phases, and each one kind of contributed to the current paradox. So from the 1950s to 1970s, during Italy's big economic boom, it was largely the quality control era. Focus was on finished product control. Companies like FIAT adopted American models for inspection. It was reactive, find the defects, and discard them. Simple as that. Then the 1970s to 1990s brought the quality assurance era. Attention shifted to production processes, leading to documented systems. ISO 9000, released in 1987, was a major turning point here. But here's where the seeds of the vorrei ma non posso paradox really started to get sown. The crucial third phase from about 1990 to 2010 was the certification season. This period saw this rapid proliferation of ISO 9001 certifications across Italy, driven largely by market demands. Now, while this certainly spread awareness, Plavsic argues it often led to a formal adherence rather than substantial integration.
The paper chase.
It's exactly, the paper chase. Companies developed complex documented systems primarily to pass the audit, which were often poorly integrated into daily operations. And this formalistic approach is a direct contributor to quality being perceived as a bureaucratic nuisance, this heavy detached layer rather than an intrinsic part of creating value. Finally, from 2010 to the present, we're sort of in the integrated approach era. Revisions of ISO 9001, particularly the 2015 version, tried to push beyond bureaucracy, introducing concepts like risk-based thinking, emphasizing leadership. Complementary approaches like Lean, Six Sigma, Agile gained traction. But the legacy of that certification season that focused on formalism often lingers. And Plavsic highlights some specific Italian peculiarities that exacerbate this. There's this persistent dualism between large enterprises, which are often at the forefront, and the huge number of small and medium-sized enterprises, SMEs, where implementation has been slower and often more superficial. The public sector's inconsistent influence has also played a role, but perhaps most telling is the impact of the national culture. A tendency towards formalism, often combined with a certain creativity in interpreting standards.
Ah, bending the rules a bit.
Well, let's say interpreting them flexibly. And this unique blend has historically generated that very contradiction between theory and practice, that deep-rooted vorrei ma non posso, where the desire for quality is met with a reluctance to embrace its substance because of the perceived bureaucratic burdens. This historical context really helps us understand why quality can feel like such a heavy imposition today.
So the landscape is clearly complex. It's evolved from simple control to a deeply integrated view, yet it's carrying the baggage of past implementations. It's not just one historical path, is it? There's this whole array of different modern approaches, which in itself can contribute to that vorrei ma non posso feeling of being utterly overwhelmed by choice, making the journey feel even more daunting.
That's very true. Over the past few decades, numerous quality management models have emerged, each with distinct philosophies, distinct applications. For an organization trying to move beyond that I can't mindset, this plurality, while potentially rich, can indeed create significant confusion, a sense of being lost in options. Plavsic categorizes these into four general types. First, you have normative models like the ISO 9000 family. They define requirements for management systems, primarily focused on conformity and certification. Then there are excellence models like EFQM or Malcolm Baldrige in the US. These are frameworks that go beyond mere compliance, aiming for overall performance improvement through self-assessment. Next are methodological approaches like Lean Management and Six Sigma. These are structured methodologies focused on process improvement, defect reduction using analytical tools. And finally, agile approaches like Scrum and Kanban. These are emerging models defined by flexibility, iteration, strong focus on customer value. Originated in software, but they're spreading. The key insight from Plavsic isn't just that these models exist, but that while they can be integrated, choosing and implementing them effectively requires a deep understanding of the organizational context, the specific needs, the strategic objectives. There's absolutely no one-size-fits-all solution here. Adopting models uncritically without true internal alignment can very easily generate these ineffective systems.
And reinforce the problem.
Exactly. It's a major trap. You adopt a model, it doesn't quite fit, it feels like more bureaucracy, and it reinforces that core perception of quality as a burden. It feeds the vorrei ma non posso loop. The very complexity of choice can make management freeze, feel overwhelmed, and just reluctant to invest the time and effort.
Okay, let's talk about one of the most widely adopted models then, the ISO 9001. It's often seen as the gateway to quality, but as you've highlighted, it frequently ends up reinforcing that bureaucratic perception, making it feel like a nuisance rather than a solution. Why is that?
Yeah, you're right. ISO 9001 is probably the most widespread approach globally, but it certainly generates mixed feelings, very mixed. In its essence, ISO 9001 proposes a systemic approach to quality management based on solid principles like customer focus, leadership, continuous improvement. The 2015 revision even strengthened its potential by emphasizing organizational context, risk-based thinking, aiming for more flexibility and documentation. Plavsic uses a great metaphor. ISO 9001 is like a map. It can guide you towards quality, but you have to make the journey, choosing the path best suited to your organization. Which implies it's meant to be a flexible guide, right? Not a rigid, predefined route. However, despite this potential in practice, especially as observed in Italy, we frequently see these problematic implementations. Implementations that lead directly to bureaucratic systems, poorly integrated with real operations, and perceived as external impositions. And this bureaucratic drift, it has several core causes, which directly feed that nuisance perception. Often it's a formalistic approach. Organizations adopt ISO 9001 primarily for market demands or contractual requirements. They focus only on certification itself, not genuine improvement.
The certificate on the wall.
That's it. The certificate on the wall, which leads to overly complex, superficial documentation designed just to pass the audit, not to actually create value. Another big issue is rigid interpretation. Despite the standard's intended flexibility, sometimes consultants or auditors propose excessively rigid interpretations, imposing standardized solutions ill-suited to specific organizational characteristics. This creates complex procedures and documentation even when it's unnecessary, which managers rightfully see as redundant and burdensome. Then there's poor involvement. Implementation is frequently just fully delegated to the quality function without real active involvement from leadership and other departments. This results in these parallel systems, disconnected from real decision-making and operations, making quality an isolated function, not a core business driver. And finally, the cultural dimension is often neglected. The focus stays on technical and documentary aspects, overlooking the profound cultural change needed to truly integrate quality principles into daily practices. This creates systems that are formally compliant, sure, but substantially ineffective and deeply frustrating for anyone trying to make them work. Yet Plavsic also points to numerous cases of virtuous implementations where ISO 9001 has genuinely improved organizational performance. Moving past the vorrei ma non posso, these successes share common elements. A strategic approach where quality is seen as integral to the business, involve leadership actively participating, leading by example, a focus on key processes that generate value, simplifying bureaucracy rather than creating it, leveraging digitalization to reduce the documentation burden and streamline processes, widespread training so all employees understand their contribution, and effective continuous improvement mechanisms that genuinely drive progress. The key, as Plavsic emphasizes, is to adopt a balanced approach, one that truly adapts its fundamental principles to the organization's specifics, turning the map into a successful journey, not just a pile of papers.
Okay, so ISO 9001, when done wrong, can actually add to the problem, reinforcing that burden feeling. What about other models like Total Quality Management, Lean, Six Sigma, and Agile? Does they fare any better, or do they also fall into the same traps in the Italian context, perpetuating that sense of it's too much effort?
That's an excellent question, because while these models offer different pathways, yes, they too can fall prey to the vorrei ma non posso paradox if they're misapplied or misunderstood. Take Total Quality Management, or TQM. We know it's this comprehensive managerial philosophy born in Japan, placing quality at the core of everything. Principles like extreme customer focus, total involvement, it offers tools like QFD, FAOA. But Plavsic notes that precisely because it's a philosophy, not a rigid certifiable framework, it demands a profound cultural shift and real long-term commitment. This can be a huge hurdle in organizations stuck in that vorrei ma non posso mindset, where leaders might be looking for quick, visible returns on investment. TQM's holistic long-term nature can seem too abstract or just too much effort. Lean management, evolving from the Toyota production system, focuses relentlessly on eliminating muda or waste. We all know the eight types, from overproduction to unused talent. Lean offers very practical tools like value stream mapping, 5S. In Italy, Plavsic highlights that Lean has gained significant traction because of its concrete, tangible approach. Its ability to generate visible results relatively quickly.
People can see the difference.
Exactly. This makes it particularly effective for organizations stuck in that vorrei ma non posso mindset. It offers immediate, visible proof of value and efficiency. It breaks down the perception that quality is just a cost or an abstract concept. It helps demonstrate that quality is efficiency. Six Sigma, by contrast, is a highly rigorous, data-driven approach, aimed at drastically reducing process variability to near perfection levels. It uses the structured DMAIC methodology. Six Sigma projects are typically evaluated by their financial impact, which should help make the case for investment. However, Plavsic notes its adoption in Italy has been more limited, primarily to large multinationals. Why? Well, due to the high statistical competence required, significant investment in training and specialized software, and crucially, a cultural resistance sometimes to an approach perceived as overly mathematical and rigid.
It doesn't fit the culture sometimes.
It can clash with a more flexible, maybe creative Italian tradition. Often gets hybridized with Lean, becoming Lean Six Sigma, to try and balance that rigor with flexibility, aiming to overcome that cultural barrier. And finally, agile approaches. While born in software development, they are spreading. We know agile values individuals working software, customer collaboration, responding to change. Now, while seemingly contrasting with traditional structured quality systems that often demand standardization and extensive documentation, Plavsic points out strong potential synergies. Both agile and modern quality systems prioritize the customer, embrace continuous improvement, aim to deliver real value. Methodologies like Scrum and Kanban integrate quality directly into iterative work cycles, allowing for continuous checks and adaptation. This raises an important question. Can these seemingly contrasting philosophies actually work together to create more adaptable, more effective quality systems? Moving beyond the vorrei ma non posso by offering flexible, value-driven paths to quality rather than rigid impositions. The challenge, as always, is cultural adaptation.
What really stands out here is that there's definitely no one-size-fits-all solution, and the journey is just fraught with potential pitfalls if these models aren't adapted correctly. The right approach to quality seems to depend entirely on the organization, its history, its culture, but understanding how these models interact with and either perpetuate or potentially solve the vere manon posso paradox, that feels like the first crucial step. Moving beyond that feeling of being overwhelmed and truly beginning to address quality, not as a nuisance, but as a strategic asset. Okay, so we've dissected the problem pretty thoroughly, the paradox, the deeply ingrained obstacles, why it feels like such a nuisance to management, particularly for those critical management reviews. Now, the real question, how do we actually bridge this gap? How do organizations genuinely move from, I would like to, but I can't to, I want to, and I can't?
All right, this is where we pivot to the solutions. And our source makes it abundantly clear. Leadership is perhaps the single most determining factor for success or failure. Full stop. That impossibility managers sometimes express often masks a lack of authentic, visible commitment from the very top. Without strong, engaged leadership, even the most sophisticated methodologies and well-intentioned efforts are likely to falter. Effective leadership for quality requires active, visible, consistent involvement, demonstrated through concrete behaviors and coherent strategic choices. This means leaders must first define an inspiring vision for quality, one that explicitly links it to core business goals and the overall mission. This goes way beyond just a slogan. It's about making quality's strategic role crystal clear. Second, they absolutely must lead by example, showing personal commitment by actively participating in reviews, in audits, in problem solving, not just delegating it all away.
Showing up matters.
Showing up matters, hugely. Third, they need to align systems and structures, ensuring that everything from strategy and objectives to incentives and daily practices is coherent with quality principles. This is crucial for overcoming that cost perception by demonstrating real embedded investment. Fourth, leaders must allocate adequate resources, time, people, budget, technologies, steadily over time, avoiding those inconsistent stop-and-go approaches that just undermine credibility. Fifth, they need to actively develop widespread competence throughout the organization, investing in both technical skills and soft skills like problem solving and collaboration, directly addressing that skills gap we talked about. And finally, they must promote responsibility and transparency, creating a culture where everyone feels accountable for quality results, embracing both successes and failures as learning opportunities, not things to hide. As Plavsic powerfully states, the quality of an organization can never exceed the quality of its leadership. When leaders consider quality as a nuisance or a cost, this perception inevitably propagates throughout the entire structure. This isn't just one factor among many. It's a defining factor. It sets the upper limit for an organization's excellence. It means transforming quality from an aspirational ideal to a tangible reality truly begins at the very top. By converting that vere manon posso into a genuine, committed I can.
Okay, but even with strong leadership, if the message isn't landing right, if people aren't understanding why quality matters or how to achieve it, you're kind of back to square one. Communication becomes absolutely paramount, but not just any communication.
Exactly. Communication and quality are just inextricably linked. Even the best methodologies, the best procedures, can be rendered totally ineffective without clear, consistent, and pervasive communication. Plavsic highlights how common communication problems act as these invisible but powerful barriers, directly contributing to the vore manon posso paradox. Typical issues. Overly technical or bureaucratic jargon that just alienates non-specialists. Information overload that drowns out key messages. One-way communication that stifles feedback. Inconsistency between formal messages and informal behaviors, what leaders say versus what they do. And an excessive focus on negative aspects like nonconformities, which unfortunately creates a defensive, compliant-only climate. So to combat this, effective strategies need to transform communication from just a broadcast into a real dialogue. This means simplifying and clarifying language, using relatable examples, stories, personalizing messages for different internal audiences, diversifying channels, think engaging meetings, vibrant newsletters, interactive intranets, clear visual management boards, maybe even internal video series or podcasts to reach everyone where they are.
Meeting people where they are.
Precisely. It's crucial to create genuine spaces for dialogue and two-way feedback, like suggestion systems or open forums where employees actually feel heard. Valuing and celebrating success stories is also vital. Make quality achievements visible, tangible. Shift the perception from burden to win. And critically, you have to measure communication effectiveness. Are the messages actually understood? Are they having an impact? Digitalization offers huge opportunities here, right? Integrated QM-sized platforms, mobile apps, visualization dashboards can make communication more effective, timely, engaging. The key is to communicate not just the what procedures and how tools, but the why, strategic reasons, and the results, successes and challenges. That's how you truly shift mindset and overcome the nuisance perception.
So it's not just about what you say, but also ensuring everyone has the skills to actually act on it. Proper training, then, isn't just a compliance item. It's a strategic necessity for dismantling those I can't excuses.
That's absolutely right. Training in quality is truly one of the most strategic investments for effective quality implementation. It directly addresses that competence gap we discussed earlier. Plavsic identifies a pervasive lack of adequate skills at all levels as a primary cause of the Vorre-Manampasso paradox, creating this persistent gap between aspirations and concrete achievements. Effective quality training has to go beyond simply transmitting technical notions. It needs to be an integrated approach that combines knowledge, abilities, and attitudes to create deep, sustainable change in behaviors and organizational practices. This progression moves from merely building awareness to fostering knowledge, to developing practical competence, to embedding new behaviors, and finally, hopefully, to creating an enduring quality culture. In Italy, quality training faces specific challenges, especially in SMEs. They often perceive it purely as a cost, not a strategic investment. So to overcome this, innovative strategies are essential. Contextualized programs that use real-world organizational examples directly relevant to people's work. Blended learning, combining traditional classroom, e-learning, coaching, on-the-job training for maximum flexibility and reach. Experiential approaches that prioritize learning by doing through simulations, practical labs, allowing people to actually feel the benefits. Fostering communities of practice for peer-to-peer knowledge sharing and problem-solving. Micro-learning with short, focused content easily consumed in daily workflows. And using gamification sometimes to make learning more engaging, more competitive. Critically, there must be a focus on evaluating impact. Not just do they learn it, but how do competencies transfer to practice? Do they genuinely improve performance? This directly counters the waste of time perception of training. And a particularly crucial aspect, often overlooked, is leadership training. Leaders need not only technical skills, but also the capacity for strategic vision, enabling them to truly understand and communicate quality as a driver of competitive advantage. They need skills in change management to effectively guide transformation processes, address resistance, overcome cultural obstacles. And they need strong coaching and development skills to support their team's growth, provide constructive feedback, create continuous learning opportunities. Without this investment in leadership capabilities, quality just remains an uphill battle, a perceived burden.
Okay, this brings us to what feels like a major game changer. How technology can actively dismantle those I can't excuses. Moving quality from a perceived burden to a streamlined, proactive advantage that could fundamentally change how management views it.
Absolutely. Digital transformation in quality is enabling a true paradigm shift. It's directly addressing many of those Vorre-Manampasso roadblocks. Digital technologies aren't just new tools. They're changing how we conceive and implement quality systems entirely. This transformative potential shows up in automating repetitive tasks, creating new modes of collaboration, enabling advanced data analysis, and redesigning the user experience of quality management systems, making them less of a chore. Key digital tools highlighted by Plavsic include integrated digital QMS platforms. These centralize documentation, nonconformities, corrective actions, audits, training, risk management, eliminating information silos and the need for cumbersome paper trails.
Less paper, less burden.
It's exactly. Mobile applications bring quality directly to the field, allowing for inspections, data collection, procedure consultation right there on a tablet or phone, integrating quality processes into the daily workflow instead of them being perceived as separate, additional time-consuming activities. And collaborative tools facilitate real-time information sharing and co-creation, democratizing quality by making it a diffused collective responsibility rather than just some siloed department's problem. The benefits are manifold and directly counter that burden perception. Increased efficiency and productivity through automation and intelligent search. Enhanced effectiveness from advanced analytics and real-time monitoring that offers true insights, not just data. Improved user experience, making systems more intuitive, less frustrating. And robust compliance and governance through complete traceability and automated controls that reduce human error. In the Italian context, digitalization offers SMEs access to advanced quality systems with lower initial investment, which is huge. Though, sure, cultural and digital literacy barriers still need addressing.
But the potential to move beyond paper-based, time-consuming processes is enormous.
Let's get even more specific then. How is automation, for instance, directly impacting quality control on the ground, making it less of a manual burden and more of a precision process?
Yeah, automation and quality control is a huge game changer because it takes the burden out of so many quality checks, replacing laborious, error-prone human tasks with machine precision. Plavzik details the integration of technologies like vision systems that use high-resolution cameras and algorithms for inspections at speeds and precisions just impossible for humans. Think about detecting microscopic defects on a fast-moving production line. A human eye just can't keep up reliably. Then there are advanced sensor networks that monitor critical parameters in real time, enabling proactive, preventive control rather than just reactive fixes after something's gone wrong. We're also seeing collaborative robotics, cobots, that combine robotic precision with human flexibility. They can take over repetitive, high-volume inspection tasks without requiring a full factory retooling. Automated metrology using things like 3D scanners allows for comprehensive, non-destructive dimensional checks, eliminating the need for slow manual measurements. Automatic statistical control identifies trends and anomalies in production data in real time, alerting management before a problem escalates into major waste. And digital twins, these virtual replicas of processes or products, allow for advanced simulations and virtual testing, meaning quality can be built in and verified in a virtual environment before a single physical product is even made, drastically reducing rework and waste. The benefits are profound and directly address that nuisance perception, unparalleled precision and objectivity, eliminating human variability and subjectivity, drastic increases in speed and efficiency, allowing for 100% control even on large volumes, complete traceability and compliance with automatic documentation, meaning less manual paperwork, less burden, and true predictive improvement, intercepting deviations before they become defects. Now, initial investments can be high, and specialized skills are needed, sure. Plavzik notes that in Italy, this is part of the broader Industry 4.0 push, but SME adoption still lags behind larger companies, often due to that inherent vremo non posso resistance to upfront investment.
And automation leads naturally to another massive shift, using data to predict problems before they even happen. This moves us from simply reacting to defects to proactively preventing them, which sounds like the ultimate way to reduce the perceived waste of time in quality activities.
Exactly. Predictive quality, leveraging big data and advanced analytics, represents a fundamental paradigm shift that directly counters the waste of time argument. Think about it. Traditional quality control is reactive. It identifies defects that are already there, often late in the process. But Plavzik emphasizes the rule of 10, which illustrates how costs increase exponentially the later a defect is detected in the life cycle. Finding a design flaw might cost pennies. Finding it on a finished product costs dollars. Finding it out in the field with a customer costs hundreds or thousands.
Ouch!
Predictive analytics shifts intervention right back to the prevention phase, which is the most economically efficient and, frankly, the least burdensome place to fix things. This proactive approach relies on several key elements: multi-level data collection from IoT sensors, MESERP systems, customer feedback, creating this comprehensive digital footprint. This raw data then undergoes rigorous preparation and integration to become structured and usable. Then, predictive models using machine learning and AI identify complex correlations, hidden patterns, continuously learning and improving their predictive capability. And finally, decision systems translate these predictions into concrete actions, from automated alarms to maybe automatic parameter adjustments on a production line. The benefits are incredibly powerful and directly address the cost and time concerns. Drastic defect reduction, optimized resource utilization, improved product reliability, significant reduction in total quality costs by stopping issues early, faster improvement cycles, and greater adaptability to changing conditions. However, in Italy, challenges remain, especially for SMEs. There's a significant competence gap in data science, often inadequate data infrastructure, cultural resistance sometimes to fully data-driven approaches, and the need for substantial initial investments. Overcoming these requires a gradual strategic approach, starting with pilot projects in critical areas to quickly demonstrate tangible value and break through that vremo non posso barrier.
And one of the biggest enablers for predictive quality and that real-time monitoring that eliminates those blind spots is the Internet of Things, IoT. How is IoT specifically transforming quality, and what tangible results are companies actually seeing from it?
Indeed. IoT for quality monitoring is truly transforming quality from this episodic control, checking samples now and then, to continuous proactive management. It creates this ecosystem of interconnected devices, smart sensors embedded in machines, products, even environments, connected through edge computing capabilities to real-time dashboards and analytics platforms. This allows for constant collection and analysis of data, completely eliminating the blind spots of traditional sample-based controls. It shifts quality from being a periodic check to being a continuous heartbeat of the operation. This constant data flow means 247 monitoring, enabling true prevention by identifying deviations and anomalies early before they escalate into defects. It ensures objectivity through consistent sensor data, removing human error or subjectivity from measurements. And it fosters integration by connecting data across the product lifecycle and various business processes, giving a holistic view of quality performance. In Italy, Plavzik highlights that IoT offers specific opportunities to enhance the renowned Made in Italy quality by adding a layer of high-tech precision to traditional craftsmanship. And the impact statistics from our source are quite compelling. Companies report a 73% reduction in response times to quality issues, moving from hours or days down to minutes. That dramatically reduces downtime and customer impact. There's an average 42% reduction in production defects for organizations adopting continuous IoT monitoring. That's a massive direct cost saving. And Italian SMEs that have implemented IoT systems for quality monitoring report an average annual savings of approximately 27,000 euro per production line through reduced waste, rework, and complaints. That makes a pretty clear business case against the cost perception, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a hard number to ignore.
Of course, challenges exist. Security and privacy concerns are huge with IoT. Managing vast amounts of data, integrating with existing legacy systems, developing new competencies within the workforce. But by starting with critical points, piloting projects to prove value, building scalable infrastructure, and integrating IoT data directly into decision-making processes, organizations can effectively evolve towards fully predictive systems, making quality truly proactive and undeniably valuable.
What's really clear here is that these technologies aren't just gadgets or nice-to-haves. They're foundational shifts. They allow organizations to proactively manage quality, moving it decisively from a cost center and a perceived nuisance to a powerful value creator. They directly address those ICANT roadblocks that management often faces by providing concrete, measurable solutions. Okay, so ultimately, all this focus on processes and systems, on technology and data, it leads to one critical point. The customer. Because in the end, quality isn't defined by internal standards or an auditor's checklist, is it? It's defined by them. They are the ultimate arbiter, and their perspective is what truly defines success.
That's a fundamental paradigm shift that Plavzik emphasizes repeatedly. Quality, in ultimate analysis, is defined by the customer. This means moving beyond focusing solely on internal specifications to really understanding and systematically integrating the customer's perspective. And it's complex, right? It encompasses objective elements, subjective elements, direct experiences, and often those unarticulated implicit expectations. The Kanno model is a really valuable framework for understanding this. It moves beyond just a simple satisfaction scale. It distinguishes between different categories of customer requirements. You have must-be requirements. These are basic expectations. If they're absent, they cause strong dissatisfaction, but their presence doesn't significantly increase satisfaction. Think of your car starting every single time. You expect it.
Taken for granted.
Exactly. Then there are performance requirements, where satisfaction is proportional to the level of performance, like fuel efficiency in a car. More is better. And crucially, delighters. These are unexpected features that generate high satisfaction when present, but whose absence doesn't cause dissatisfaction. Think of a surprise upgrade on a flight. The key insight for quality is that today's delighters very quickly become tomorrow's must-haves, constantly pushing the bar for innovation and continuous improvement. The Serv-Equal model further elaborates this by identifying five dimensions of perceived service quality that every manager should really internalize. Reliability, performing the promised service accurately and consistently. Reactivity, the willingness to help and provide timely service. Assurance, encompassing the competence, courtesy, and trustworthiness of staff. Empathy, the individualized attention and care given to customers. Intangibles, the physical appearance of facilities, equipment, personnel. In the Italian context, Made in Italy itself creates particularly high expectations in all these dimensions, which is both an immense opportunity and a significant challenge to consistently meet. To truly integrate the customer perspective and make quality resonate beyond just internal metrics, organizations need robust approaches. Things like Voice of the Customer VOC programs to systematically gather feedback from diverse sources, surveys, interviews, social media listening, customer journey mapping to visualize all customer interactions and pinpoint pain points. Quality function deployment, QFD, to translate abstract customer needs into concrete technical specifications. and using customer-centric KPIs like Net Promoter Score, NPS, Customer Satisfaction Score, CSAT, and Customer Effort Score, CES. These align the entire organization around customer-focused objectives, making quality not just a department's goal, but a shared, measurable mission.
But how do you actually quantify something as subjective as satisfaction or experience? It feels elusive, almost unmeasurable, which could easily lead management to dismiss investing in it, seeing it as another immeasurable burden.
It is challenging, definitely, but it's absolutely fundamental
yeah.
because it transforms perceived quality into measurable ROI. Directly countering that it's just a cost argument. Plavzik outlines key metrics and some pretty impressive statistics that demonstrate this. The Net Promoter Score, NPS, for example, asks that simple question, how likely are you to recommend company product to a friend or colleague on a 0-10 scale?
Yeah.
Categorizes customers into detractors, passives, promoters. It's simple, widely used, great for benchmarking. Customer Satisfaction Score, CSET, measures satisfaction with specific interactions, usually on a 1-5-5 or 1-10 scale, gives granular feedback that can pinpoint issues in a specific process or touch point. The Customer Effort Score, CES, measures the effort required by a customer to complete an action or resolve a problem, because ease of interaction is often more important than delight for keeping customers loyal.
Less hassle is good.
Less hassle is very good. And finally, Customer Lifetime Value, CLV, quantifies the total economic value a customer generates over their entire relationship with the company. This offers a long-term financial view that connects quality directly to profit. And the statistics are compelling. Companies that systematically measure customer satisfaction and actually act on the results see an average 68% increase in customer retention. For every euro invested in customer satisfaction measurement and improvement, Plavzik highlights a remarkable 6 ROI. Considering the impact on retention, cross-selling, reduced acquisition costs.
6 euros back for every euro spent. That's significant.
Very significant. And organizations integrating customer feedback into decision-making report an average 25% reduction in churn rate. These aren't soft benefits. They are hard numbers. Numbers that should silence any manager who still sees quality as just a cost or an annoyance. Data collection needs to be multifaceted, sure. Using periodic surveys, transactional feedback, interviews, social listening, behavioral analysis from digital platforms. But the crucial step, and often the sticking point, is turning data into action. So many organizations gather vast amounts of feedback that then just sits there unused, which leads to that disconnection and makes the measurement itself feel like a waste of time. To overcome this, you need clear governance processes for data analysis, broad dissemination of results at all levels, linking metrics to incentives to drive behavior, and establishing cross-functional discussion platforms to ensure insights lead to concrete improvements and the elimination of those non-quality costs.
Okay, this is where it gets really powerful, I think. It's not just about the product itself anymore, but the entire journey the customer takes, before, during, and after the purchase. This feels like the new frontier of quality that really makes it strategic, doesn't it?
That's absolutely the core of the from product quality to experience quality paradigm shift. It's a holistic view, encompassing emotions, perceptions, values throughout the entire customer relationship. The source puts it beautifully. Quality is not just what we put in the product, but what the customer derives from the overall experience. This means moving beyond just functional quality. Does it work? Is it reliable? To deeper experiential dimensions, like emotional impact, symbolic meaning, the quality of the relationship itself, how the experience integrates into the customer's life. This is what makes quality a true differentiator, not just a minimum standard. And this experience, it unfolds across multiple stages. Pre-purchase, like how easy is it to find information online? Is the communication clear? Purchase, is the transaction smooth, transparent, or the staff competent? Usage, is it usable, intuitive, is there sheer pleasure in using it? And post-usage, is there responsive after-sales support, effortless problem resolution, engaging loyalty programs, responsible product end-of-life options? Each phase critically contributes to the overall perception of quality. And any breakdown at any point can negate excellent product quality. Designing these kinds of experiences requires specific methodologies, things like customer journey mapping, creating detailed personas to understand user needs, service blueprinting to visualize all the touch points, co-creation workshops with customers, design thinking, balancing desirability, technical feasibility, economic viability. Challenges exist, of course. Organizational complexity due to functional silos is a big one. That needs to be overcome by strong leadership shared objectives. Measuring this multidimensional experience requires sophisticated metrics, combining quantitative and qualitative data. There's also that delicate balance between standardization to ensure consistent quality and personalization to meet individual needs. And finally, customer expectations evolve continuously. demanding an organizational capacity for continuous evolution based on constant listening, experimentation, agility. This is where quality becomes a truly dynamic strategic asset.
And this focus on the customer's overall experience leads directly to what feels like the holy grail for businesses, loyalty. Because a loyal customer isn't just a repeat buyer, they're a brand advocate, a source of consistent revenue, and frankly, probably a much less burdensome customer to serve in the long run.
Absolutely. The link between quality and customer loyalty generates profound impacts on profitability, stability, sustainable growth. Quality, broadly defined as the consistent ability to meet and exceed expectations, is the most solid foundation for building lasting customer relationships. Understanding this connection is what transforms quality from a perceived cost into a strategic investment, which is how organizations truly overcome that vorrei ma non posso paradox. The economic value of loyalty, as Plavsic stresses, is substantial. A mere 5% increase in customer retention can boost profitability by 25% to 95%, depending on the sector.
25 to 95%, that's huge.
It's a massive multiplier effect. And it stems from several factors. Acquiring a new customer costs, on average, 5 to 20 times more than retaining an existing one. Furthermore, loyal customers spend, on average, 67% more than new customers. They show higher purchase frequency, larger average tickets, more openness to premium products and services. They're also less price sensitive. The mechanisms through which quality fosters loyalty are numerous and synergistic. Consistent quality builds satisfaction, then trust, dramatically reducing the perceived risk of repurchasing. Superior quality increases the perceived value, making competitors' offers just less attractive. Positive experiences create psychological switching costs, making customers hesitant to change, even without formal contracts. Excellence can generate identity and belonging, especially when a brand's values align with customer values, creating deep emotional bonds. Satisfied customers become spontaneous brand promoters through positive word of mouth, online reviews. And over time, organizations can progressively personalize their offerings based on accumulated customer knowledge, creating this virtuous cycle of increasing value and retention. In Italy, the strong tradition of artisanal quality and personal relationships provides a fertile ground for structured loyalty strategies based on these very principles, making the Made in Italy brand potentially very powerful if leveraged correctly. Measuring loyalty involves metrics like retention rate, share of wallet, customer lifetime value, NPS. Strategies include segmenting customers by value, identifying specific loyalty drivers unique to different segments, mapping the entire customer lifecycle to pinpoint critical moments for quality impact, developing targeted excellence programs, implementing early warning systems for churn risk, and creating continuous feedback loops to leverage loyal customer insights for ongoing improvement. This whole approach requires shifting from viewing loyalty as just a simple reward system to recognizing it as a direct outcome of consistently delivered high-quality experiences and relationships.
Okay, so to wrap up this deep dive, there's another crucial convergence that's really redefining quality. It's inextricable link with sustainability. These aren't just buzzwords anymore. They're becoming two sides of the same coin for long-term organizational health. And understanding this can further dismantle that quality as burden perception.
Yes, this is a powerful and increasingly vital convergence. Quality and sustainability, which were once seen as separate, maybe even conflicting goals, are now deeply intertwined. Recognizing this connection can significantly help overcome the vorrei ma non posso paradox, transforming both quality and sustainability from perceived constraints into strategic opportunities. The convergence manifests in several powerful ways. Quality management by optimizing processes and reducing errors inherently promotes resource efficiency, leading to less waste, lower energy consumption, or reduced environmental footprint. Proactive quality approaches also help in risk mitigation, addressing compliance and social expectations, thus reducing legal and reputational risks associated with environmental or social missteps. Innovation is also driven by sustainability constraints, forcing companies to rethink products and processes to be more eco-friendly, which often leads to competitive advantages and new market opportunities. Integrated certifications also open up new market access, particularly in regions or industries with strong sustainability requirements. And crucially, commitment to both quality and sustainability helps in talent attraction and retention, especially for younger generations who prioritize these values in their employers. This convergence is reflected in the evolution of management standards too, with ISO's high-level structure, HLS, facilitating integrated management systems that combine quality, ISO 9001, environmental, ISO 14001, energy, ISO 5001, health and safety, ISO 4001, and social responsibility, ISO 26000. This integration makes it easier for organizations to manage these aspects holistically rather than as separate, potentially burdensome silos. In the Italian context, this connection has unique nuances. Strengths include the artisanal tradition's emphasis on durability and intrinsic quality, which naturally aligns with sustainability principles like longevity, waste reduction. The deep ties of many Italian SMEs to their local territories also foster a natural attention to local environmental and social impact. And the inherent creativity and flexibility hallmarks have made in Italy can facilitate sustainable innovation. However, challenges persist, such as the fragmentation into smaller enterprises, limiting resources for systemic investments, a tendency sometimes towards short-term focus, and the complexity of regulations being perceived as onerous, particularly for smaller entities. Operationally, this integration can be seen in sustainable design, where products are designed for durability, repairability, responsible end of life. It's visible in efficient processes using Lean and Six Sigma, not just for economic efficiency, but also for ecological benefits, like reducing energy and material consumption. And it extends to a sustainable supply chain, where quality and sustainability criteria are applied to partners, optimizing logistics, ensuring end-to-end transparency. The benefits are clear. Reduced operational costs, mitigated risks, enhanced innovation, new market access, greater talent attraction. This raises an important question for any organization, really. Can you truly achieve long-term quality excellence without embedding sustainability at your very core? It's becoming less of a choice and more of an imperative, I think. So we've connected all this back to the bigger picture. The journey through quality, from being that perceived bureaucratic burden, a mere compliance exercise, to becoming a strategic driver, it requires a profound shift, a shift in mindset, authentic leadership, and how we intelligently leverage technology and deep customer insights. Plazek's work makes it unequivocally clear that management's reluctance to engage with activities like management reviews, often seeing them as that annoying waste of time, isn't an isolated issue. It's a symptom of this broader but ultimately solvable challenge.
Yeah, what stands out to you, hopefully, listening, is that the vorrei, ma non posso, that feeling of wanting to achieve quality but being held back by perceived constraints, it's not an unavoidable reality. It really is a solvable paradox. It's about understanding the deep roots of resistance, especially among management, and strategically applying the right tools, technology, methodologies, and most importantly, cultivating the right mindset. A mindset where quality is no longer seen as a separate, annoying task imposed from outside. It comes back to that central idea, doesn't it? Quality is not just a department or a checklist or a formal review meeting you have to endure. It's a culture, it's a strategy. And ultimately, it's a powerful driver of sustainable value. So the next time you face a quality task, particularly maybe that management review, instead of seeing it as a nuisance, perhaps consider this. What if the biggest waste of time isn't the review itself, but actually the missed opportunity? The opportunity to truly unlock excellence, drastically reduce hidden costs, and profoundly deepen your connection with your customers.